To everybody, on behalf of Torah Motion, I want to welcome you to, I guess, the fourth in our series from 5781 and the Parshat HaShavua. It's a pleasure to welcome for the first time to Torah Motion, Rabbi Wendy Amsalem, who directs the Beit Midrash program, a joint program of Yeshivat Maharat and Yeshivat Chovevei Torah. She teaches at Maharat, is the editor of their Karen Journal. She is a graduate of the Jewish Scholars Circle, is a Wexner Graduate Fellow, a Mandel Jerusalem Fellow, and a graduate of Harvard University. So it's a pleasure to welcome her to teach tonight. And tonight's shiur is being sponsored by Leanne Granofsky and Dan Rabinowitz, and we want to thank them. And Vakasha Wendy, it's all yours.
Thank you so much. So first of all, I feel extremely lucky to get to be the person who's teaching about Parshat Vayera. So great, right? All the Bereshit Parshiot are so wonderful. And there are many great things that happen in Parshat Vayera, but the particular story that I want to focus on is the story of the birth of Yitzchak and the sending away of Yishmael. And in order to kind of really have a sense of what's going on in that story, which happens in chapter 21, we're going to start kind of looking at the sort of the first part of that story, which actually happened in last week's parsha in chapter 16, back in Parshat Lech Lecha. I believe that if anybody wants access to the sources, you can click on the link in the chat and get to them, but I'm not gonna share my screen because I would like to see if anybody wants to ask a question or say anything. But if you have trouble getting the sources, just let us know and we can put them in the chat again. Okay, so we're at the source number one over here on the page is from chapter 16 of Bereshit. We're told over here in verse one, Visarai Eshet Avram Lo Yalda Lo, right? Sarai, Avram's wife, has not had a child. And in fact, the very first time that we first hear about Sarai back at the end of Parshat Noach, right then, the first thing we know about Sarai back then is that she's in Akara, that she's unable to have a child, she's infertile. And now we're told again, she has not given birth to a child. And almost as a seeming non sequitur, we're told the second half of the verse, V'la shifcha mitzrit u'shima Hagar. Also, she has an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. The two seem somewhat unrelated. But then in the next verse, they become united because Sarai says to Avram, Hine na'atzarani Hashem miledet. God has prevented me from having a child. I think that's even worth thinking about for a moment, right? When Sarai thinks about her infertility, it doesn't seem to her to be kind of accidental, right? She sees it as a direct action of God, right? God is stopping her from having a child. It's not just that God kind of isn't helping her have a child, but atzarani means to stop, right? God is stopping me from having a child. But you, Avram, please come to my maidservant. Perhaps I can be built up through her. And we're told by Yishma Avram Makol Sarai. Avram listens to what Sarai is asking him to do, or he's willing to do as she asks. I think the phrase ulai ibanem mimena is very important, right? Perhaps I'll be built up through her, because it lets us know that what Sarai is offering Avram is not the chance for him to have a child, right? She's not saying to him, look, God is preventing me from having a child, but I really want you to have a child, so perhaps you can go ahead and have a child with Hagar. That's not the offer that she's making. The offer that she's making is, I want you to have a child with Hagar, so that way I will be built up through Hagar. I want, right, the child that you have with Hagar will really be like my child, right? She's offering up Hagar as a surrogate, right? Not just as an opportunity for Avram to have a child with another woman, but really as an opportunity for Avram and Sarai together to have a child, kind of utilizing the surrogacy of Hagar. In verse 3, we're told, "Batikach Sarai eshet Avram et Hagar hamitzrit shivchata miketz eser shanim leshevet Avram be'eretz Kanan." So Sarai now takes Hagar, her maidservant, after she and Avram have been living together for 10 years in Canaan, Vatitenota l'Avram isha lo li'isha. She gives Hagar to her husband Avram as a wife. One thing that's worth noticing over here in verse 3 is that all of the action verbs are Sarai, right? Sarai takes Hagar, she gives Hagar to Avram, right? It's all, right? It's not just her plan, but it's also, she's totally the kind of the person who's putting it all into place. In verse 4, we're told, Vayavol Hagar Vatahar. Avram comes to Hagar and she immediately conceives, right? And I think the speed with which that seems to happen is supposed to be breathtaking, right? Sarai has been trying to have a child for years and years and years, for at least the 10 years that they've been together in Canaan, probably for a good while beforehand. She's unable to, and then kind of, we don't even make it through like a quarter of the verse and Hagar is already pregnant, right? It seems like the moment Avram is with her, Hagar conceives. And we're told, Vatera ki harata, when Hagar realizes that she's conceived, Vatekal dirta beinah, then her mistress, Sarai, becomes lowered in her eyes. Probably she assumes that maybe, you know, either God has found something wanting in Sarai, and that's why God won't let Sarai have a child, or maybe there's just something wrong with Sarai. But Hagar feels like her status now relative to her mistress has become much higher, and as a result, her mistress has become lighter in her eyes. Verse 5 is the one I really want us to focus on, right? In verse 5, Sarai turns to Avram, and she says to him, Chamasi alecha, my wrong is upon you. Anochi natati shivchati b'chekecha, I gave you my maidservant into your bosom, but tere ki harata ve'kal beineha, as soon as she realized that she was pregnant, I became lighter in her eyes, yishput Hashem b'ni u'beinecha, may God judge between us. This is a very odd moment, because we understand why Sarai is kind of angry at Hagar, right? Hagar is now suddenly not respecting her the way that she used to, but it's unclear why she's blaming this on Avram, right? She says to Avram, my wrong is upon you, may God judge between us, look what Hagar is doing to me, which seems a little bit strange, right? We would imagine that if Sarai was angry at Hagar, we'd hear her expressing that anger towards Hagar, but instead she turns to Avram and she says to him, I'm so angry at you because of what Hagar is doing to me. So even before we look at the source number 2, which is the Midrash in Bereishit Rabbah that gives a couple of explanations, I'm curious whether anybody in our group tonight has any thoughts about this, right? Why is Sarai angry at Avram specifically because of the way Hagar is treating her? Ah, okay, great. Alana has written, Avram should stand up for Sarai, right? Maybe what Sarai is saying is, I'm really angry at you, Avram, because Hagar is mistreating me and you should be doing something about it, right? You're not doing anything about it and you should be. Excellent. Okay, any other thoughts? Ah, okay, Yvonne says that maybe Sarai is really jealous, right? She's really jealous of Hagar. Well, actually, is she jealous of Hagar or is she jealous of Avram? What did you mean, Yvonne? Right, because it could be either way, right? She could be jealous of Hagar that Hagar is conceived. She could be jealous of Avram because Avram is getting to have a child, right? But because she's so jealous, right, she kind of lashes out at Avram, even though maybe actually it's Hagar who should really be the recipient of her anger. Jealous of Avram. Yeah, okay, then it would make more sense that she lashes out at Avram, right? She's jealous of Avram because Avram gets to have a child. Excellent. Okay, so in fact, both Ilana and Ivan have exactly predicted what the Midrash over here in source number 2 is going to say. If we look at source number 2, the Midrash is from over here is from Bereishit Rabbah, right? It is the collection of Midrashim specifically about the book of Genesis. And here we're told, Vatomer Sarai Avram Chamasi. Sarai says to Avram, my anger is upon you. Rabbi Yudan b'shem Rabbi Yuda, right? Rabbi Yudan said in the name of Rabbi Yuda, Chomsini at bidvari. You are wronging me with words. Lama? Why or how? Shata shomea bizyoni v'shotek. You hear my humiliation. You hear Hagar disrespecting me. And you are silent, right? So this is kind of similar to what Alana said in the chat, right? Avram should be standing up for Sarai. And Sarai says, look, the reason why I'm really angry at you is that you see what's going on and you don't intervene, right? You should be sticking up for me. I did something nice for you, Avram, right? I put myself out there. I allowed this other person kind of into our marriage and you're not protecting me, right? And that's why Sarai is so angry. My teacher, Rabbi David Silber, had a slightly different reading of this that I always liked a lot. He said that maybe what Sarai is really saying to Avram is that the way that Hagar is treating me is a reflection, Avram, of the way that you treat me, right? If you respected me more, Avram, then Hagar wouldn't dare to treat me the way that she is. But the fact that Hagar is disrespecting me means that she can tell that you don't really respect me either. And so that's why Sarai is angry at Avram, because she kind of sees in Hagar's behavior kind of a reflection of the way that Avram feels about her. Somebody here has also suggested that maybe Avram should have rejected Sarai's advice, right? That's a great reading also. I remember Belda Lindemann on the Hashalom saying that also. She felt like, she always thought that when Sarai said to Avram, Bo Nail Shifchati, come to my maidservant, what she wanted Avram to say was like, no, I would never do that. So maybe that could be part of it also. Okay, So the first reason that the Midrash gives for why Sarai is so angry at Avram is that Avram is not defending Sarai, right? He hears Hagar disrespecting Sarai, and he's not intervening, and that's why she's so angry at him. Then we have a second opinion over here of Rabbi Berechia, the name of Rabbi Abba. He says that really what Sarai is saying is Yib'i dini gabach. I ask for judgment because of you, right? That's the end part of what she says. Remember, she says in verse five, Yishpot Hashem b'ni u'b'necha, may God judge between you and me. Why is she calling upon God for judgment here? He tells the following parable. He says, "L'shnei b'nei adam shayu chavushim b'beit ha'asurim." It's comparable to two prisoners who are jailed together. Nimtza ha'melech over, the king passes by the jail. Amar lechad tavo adiki didi. One of the prisoners calls out to the king and says, "Execute judgment for me." In other words, like, let me out of this jail. The king hears him and says, "Afikute, okay, let that guy out. Let him out of jail." Amar li chavre. So now the fellow prisoner says to the one who's being let out, "Yib'i didi gabach." Right? I ask for judgment between us. Ilu amarta tavoa diki didan. If you had said, "Execute judgment for us," in the same way that the king let you out, he would be letting me out. But because you said, "Execute judgment for me," you were let out, and I was not let out. Right? So the prisoner is saying, basically, you were only thinking about yourself. If you had only thought about both of us, if you had said, "Let us out of jail," then in the same way that I was let out of jail, sorry, in the same way that you're being let out of jail, I could also be freed. But because in that moment you were only thinking about yourself, you only said, "Let me out of prison," now you're being freed and I'm still stuck here. And I think that that's wrong, the prisoner is saying, right? I'm calling judgment down upon you because you're leaving me here in jail and you didn't need to. Rabbi Brechia now explains his parable. He says, Sarai is really saying to Avram, "Kach ilu amarta holchim anu aririm," if when God told you in the previous chapter, in chapter 15, "Al tira Avram schacha harbe ma'od," right? Don't be afraid, Avram, your reward is great. If you had said in response to God, if you had said, "Holchin anu aririm," Sarai and I are both infertile, we're both childless, then kimad yehavlach ken yehavli. In the same way that God is now giving you a child, God would have also given me a child. The Chaduda mark, but because when you had the opportunity to ask God for something, you said, "Hashem Elokim matitein li manochi hole chariri," right? I am childless, because you only talked about yourself. Lecha yehav veli lo yehav. God has given you a child and not me. Right? So for Rabbi Brechia, the real source of Sarai's anger is actually not really anything having to do with Hagar, right? It's not the fact that Hagar is disrespecting her, right? That's not the real cause of the anger. The root cause of the anger, according to Rabbi Brechia, is that exactly as Yvonne suggested, right? That Sarai is angry that Avram gets to have a child and she doesn't, right? Sarai is saying, like, you, Avram, right now are getting to have a child because when you had the opportunity to ask for something for God, you asked for a child for yourself. And if you had really been thinking of us as a unit, right, if you had thought about you and me together, then you would have asked for a child for us, and then we could have had a child together. But because you said, "Anuchi holech ariri," in the singular, I am childless, then God was willing to give you a child, but God is not giving me one. And so the real source of Sarai's anger is this sort of sense that Avram isn't thinking about her, right? He's not really thinking about Sarai in terms of what she might want or in terms of them together as a unit. He's only thinking about himself. And because he was only thinking about himself, he in the end now will have a child and she won't. Okay, we look now back in source number one at the final verse over here, verse six, right? Avram hears Sarai saying to him, "I'm really angry at you. I gave you my maidservant. She sees that she's pregnant. Now I'm lighter in her eyes. May God judge between us." And Avram's response in verse six is, "Hinei shivchatech biyadech, asila hatov beinayich," right? Well, she's your maidservant. You do whatever you want to her, which is actually a really terrible thing for Avram to say, right? It's a terrible thing to do to Hagar, right? The woman who's carrying his child, right? To say to Sarai, "Oh, do whatever you want to her." And it also is probably not what Sarai was hoping to hear either, right? It sounds like what Sarai wants from Avram is some sort of reassurance that she is important to him, that he's thinking about her. And his response is basically like, whatever, you deal with this problem that you have, like, do whatever you want. I don't want to get involved. And we're told that Sarai then oppresses Hagar, and Hagar flees off into the wilderness. Many commentaries, foremost among them Ramban, they say everything about this verse is terrible, right? It's terrible that Avram kind of sort of tells Sarai that she can do whatever she wants to Hagar. It's terrible that Sarai mistreats Hagar. The Ramban sees this as the source for kind of all future troubles between descendants of Ishmael and descendants of Yitzhak and so forth. And even kind of on its face, it is kind of very cruel, right? To say to Sarai, well, do whatever you want to that pregnant woman. And then Sarai does in fact behave very cruelly to her. Hagar flees. If you remember what happens next in the chapter is that Hagar runs off, an angel of God finds Hagar, suggests to Hagar that she go back to Sarai and continue to be oppressed. Hagar is not interested in that particular offer. Eventually, the angel tells her that she'll give birth to a child. The child's name is Ishmael, because God has heard her pain and her affliction. Ishmael will grow up to be a wild man. Hagar, upon hearing this, is willing to go back. She goes back. She gives birth to this baby. Interestingly, Avraham calls the baby Ishmael. And it's not clear whether he calls the baby Ishmael because he believes that God has heard Avraham's request for a child and has given him a child, or whether he calls the baby Ishmael because he knows about the story of Hagar meeting up with the angel and being told that she'll have a child named Ishmael. It could be either one. The text doesn't tell us. Anyway, what is clear, though, by the end of Genesis chapter 16 is that whatever Sarai had been hoping for by giving Hagar to Avraham as a surrogate is not really going to work out, right? It seems like what Sarai had been hoping for was that Hagar would have a child, Sarai would adopt the child, she would be built up through having this child. But as soon as the relationship between Hagar and Sarai sours, as it does, it sort of becomes clear that that kind of dream that Sarai had was not going to happen. And, you know, whether she could have predicted that or not, I think is an interesting question. At any rate, this is all the backdrop for Genesis chapter 21, right, which is in our parasha. The Torah reading for the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which we heard not so long ago. So if we look right now in source number 3, this is Genesis chapter 21, we're told here, V'Hashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, v'yas Hashem l'Sarah kasher diber. God remembered Sarah as God said that God would, and God does for Sarah as God had spoken. And in verse 2, we're told Sarah conceives and she gives birth to a little baby boy at exactly the time that God said that the baby would be born. In verse 3, Avraham names the baby Yitzchak. Now, one thing that's interesting to know is that back at the very end of Parshat Lech Lecha, the very end of the Torah reading last week, God told Avraham that he would have a child with Sarah. And if you remember, Avram's reaction was to laugh and to say basically like, I don't need another child. I have Ishmael. Let Ishmael live before you. Let him be my covenantal child. I don't need another child. And God's response to Avram is, well, okay, you have Ishmael. Ishmael will also be a great nation. But actually, Ishmael is not Sarai's child. You're going to have a child together with Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. You and Sarah together will have a child, and that child will be the covenantal child. And it seems that Even as late as the end of Parsha Lech Lecha, Avram is still relatively unconvinced that Sarai is an important part of his destiny, right? He feels like he has this child that he had with Hagar. That's the child that he's pinned all of his hopes and dreams on. He's not interested in having another child. And God is basically educating Avram and saying, actually, it's not just all about you. It's also about your wife, Sarah. Together, you guys will have another child, and that child will be the covenantal child, Yitzchak. And here at the beginning of chapter 21, that baby is in fact born. The baby's born and the baby is called Yitzchak exactly as God instructed them. I skipped a little bit in the interest of time, but if you look in verse 8, we're told, Vayigdal hayeled vayigamal, right? The little boy, Yitzchak, grows and is weaned. And Avraham makes a great feast on the day that Yitzchak is weaned. Then we're told in verse 9, Vateres Sarah ben Hagar mitzvit asher yodal Avraham etzachek. Sarah sees the son of Hagar doing something, right? She sees him being mitzachek. The rabbis in the Midrash have a lot of different discussions about what this word mitzachek is, right? Some say that he's committing kind of grievous crimes, right? He is, he's committing idolatry, he's committing adultery, he's committing murder, right? There are a lot of terrible things that Ishmael might be doing. Other rabbis say, no, he's just laughing about the inheritance, right? He's saying, why is everybody making such a big fuss about this little baby? Obviously, I'm still the main heir because I was born first. regardless of what it is that Sarah sees Ishmael doing, she just decides that she does not want him in her home at all. And in verse 10, she says to Avram, Garish hamazot vepana, cast out this maidservant and her son, ki lo yirash ben hamazot im bnei Yitzchak, because her son will not inherit together with my son Yitzchak. We think for a moment about kind of the tone that Sarai strikes here compared to the tone that we saw back in source number one in verse five, right? She sounds very different, right? Here she's very confident. She tells Avram exactly what she wants him to do, right? She says, you must cast out this maidservant and her son because he will not inherit with my son. Right, as opposed to what she said back in chapter 16, verse 5, when she said, my wrong is upon you, I gave you my maidservant, now she's disrespecting me, may God judge between us, right? Back then, she was very upset, but she doesn't actually give Avram any action items, right? She just says, I'm very upset, may God judge between us. And Avram's response is basically, you know, do whatever you want. Here, Sarai is not taking any chances, right? She tells Avram exactly what she wants him to do. She's very clear about it. And as opposed to earlier, when Avram was kind of happy for Sarai to do whatever she wanted, right? Remember he said, you know, hinei shifatech biyadech asila tov beinayich, right? She's your maidservant, do whatever you want her. Here, though, Avram has a very different feeling about it, right? We're told in verse 11, vayira hadavar me'od beinei Avram alodot beno. The matter is very bad in Avram's eyes. He really doesn't want to send his child out, right? Now, we know that Ishmael was 13 years old when he was circumcised, and that the following, and Avram was 99 years old, and the following year when Avram is 100, Yitzchak is born. And so if Yitzchak is being weaned right now, probably the youngest he could be is probably around 3, right? So that would put Ishmael, right, the youngest that Ishmael is probably 16 or 17, right? I guess if Yitzchak was weaned at 2, maybe. So Ishmael is sort of a teenager, right? He's a 16 or 17-year-old boy. And Avraham has raised him the entire time, right? Avraham loves Ishmael. He's not remotely interested in sending Ishmael away. Sarah makes this very clear demand. And Avraham really doesn't want to do it, right? He's not interested in sending his son away. In verse 12, God appears to Avraham and says, Al yirah be'enecha al hanar v'al amatecha, don't let it be bad in your eyes regarding either the boy or your maid. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shema b'kola. Whatever Sarah tells you to do, you should do. Listen to her voice. Ki v'Yitzchak yikare lechazara, because Yitzchak is actually going to be your covenantal child, right? There's a sense that Avraham still doesn't really think of Yitzchak as the covenantal child, right? He's known Ishmael for so much longer. He's always assumed it would be Ishmael. And he kind of doesn't really see Yitzchak as being his true heir, right? He feels very invested in Ishmael. And God says, you should do what Sarah is saying, because Sarah kind of sees clearly how things should be. She understands that Yitzchak is the child that's your covenantal child. But don't worry, Ishmael will also be doing okay, right? Ishmael will also, right? Ishmael, the son of the maid, he'll also become a great nation. He's just not going to be your covenantal heir. So we're not telling you, you know, don't worry about him. He's not going to be cut off. He just won't be your covenantal child. Okay, if you remember what happens next, Avram wakes up early in the morning, he takes some bread and some water, he gives it to Hagar, he sends Hagar and the boy away. And sure enough, by the middle of verse 14, we're told, Vatelech vateta bimidbar be'er sheva. Hagar gets lost along the way. And a lot of the commentaries are very disturbed by the fact that Avram only gives them bread and water, right? Avram, by at this point in time, we know is a very wealthy man, right? And it feels like, well, this is his child who he's loved for all these years, right? It's one thing to have to send him off, right? Well, why is he only giving him bread and water? So there are many different approaches to it, right? One approach is to say, Rashi says, well, once God tells him to listen to Sarah, then Avram realizes that Ishmael has actually turned into a bad kid, and then Avraham doesn't like him anymore, and that's why he only gives him bread and water. A different approach, I believe it's Ibn Ezra's approach, is that no, Avram also gave them all sorts of treasures. He gave them gold and silver as well. The story just doesn't mention it because if you're lost in a desert, what you need is water, right? The fact that you happen to also have gold is kind of irrelevant, so it just doesn't get mentioned in the story. Ramban says that maybe when God says to Avram, do whatever Sarah tells you to, Sarah didn't want to give them anything, and so Avram was listening to her, so maybe that's why he doesn't send them off with anything. But it is striking, right, that, you know, later on when Avram is looking for a wife for Yitzchak, he sends his servant with 10 camels laden with treasure, right? You think he could give them, like, maybe one attendant to get to where they're going next. But it's just the two of them, just Hagar and Ishmael, and this bread and water. They get lost in the desert. We're told in verse 15, they run out of water. And Hagar kind of puts the boy down, sort of throws him down under one of the bushes. In verse 16, she goes sort of a distance away. And she says, I don't want to have to watch my child die. So she sits a little bit away from him. And she begins to cry. In verse 17, we're told that God hears the voice of the boy where he is. And an angel calls out to Hagar and says, Malach Hagar, al tiri ki shama Elohim el kol ha'na'ar basher husham. Don't worry, Hagar. Don't be afraid. God has heard the voice of the Nar, the voice of the boy where he is. It's an interesting moment in the story because we didn't hear Ishmael crying out. We heard Hagar crying out. So we might have thought that God, the angel would say, don't worry, Hagar, God has heard your voice. But instead, the angel says, don't worry, Hagar, God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. This leads some commentaries to say, therefore, if a person is sick, it's much better that they pray for themselves because God heard Ishmael's prayer, even though we didn't hear it before God heard Hagar's prayer. Other people think that maybe this is what it means that God hears the voice of the Na'ar where he is that God kind of just sort of judges him as he is in that moment, not kind of for any future misdeeds that he'll do. That's also supposed to sort of be encouraging for us when we hear it on Rosh Hashanah, right? God hears all of us where we are. At any rate, the angel then goes on to say to Hagar, "Kumi si et hanar v'chziki et yadech bo ki legoi gadol asimenu." Get up. Lift up the boy, strengthen your hand with him because he will become a great nation. And then in verse 19, God opens her eyes. She sees that in fact, there is a well of water. She goes, she fills up the well with water and she gives it to her son. And then we're told in verse 20, God is with the boy and he grows and he goes and he lives in the wilderness. He becomes an archer. And then in verse 21, we're told he lives in the wilderness of Paran and his mother finds him a wife from the land of Egypt. And that's kind of the end of Ishmael's story in the Torah, right? We never hear about any other encounters between Abraham and Ishmael. We kind of really don't hear anything else about Ishmael except for two other things. We're told in Parshat Chayei Sarah that when Avram dies, Ishmael comes to bury Avram. And afterwards, we're told the genealogies, right? About all of Ishmael's children and so forth. But we never hear about any other conversations or encounters between Avram and Ishmael. And I think that this kind of opens up a real difficulty in the story, right? Because it seems as if Avram is so happy with Ishmael when he's born. It's very, very hard for him to send Ishmael away. He seems very invested in Ishmael as a person and as his son. And so then it seems difficult that he could have just sent Ishmael away and kind of never wanted any future relationship with him. There's something about that feels not just very cold, but also it just kind of doesn't fit with the emotional pull of the story up until here. And the other thing that I think is a little bit strange is that if in fact Avram did totally cut Ishmael off, then why does Ishmael bother to come back to bury him, right? If Avram kind of sent him off to the desert to die, never checked in with him afterwards, it's interesting that Ishmael would kind of come home for Avram's funeral, right? That also seems a little bit unusual. And these questions kind of lead us to source number four, which is a midrash from Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is a relatively late midrash. I believe people think it was put together in sort of the 800s or the 900s in an area that was under Muslim control. As we'll see, there are some allusions to Islam in this particular midrash. And this midrash basically says, yeah, it can't be. It can't be that Avram would have sent Ishmael away without ever checking in on him, right? It can't be that this is just the end of their relationship. That chapter 21 is kind of the end of the story of the two of them. So the Midrash over here in source number four begins by saying, Shalach Ishmael v'lakach lo isha mibenot Moab. Ishmael went and found himself a wife from the daughters of Moab. Now, we just saw the end of chapter 21, right? We've never heard any mention in the Torah of a wife from Moab. I think the only potential allusion that maybe the Midrash uses to think about this wife is that Ishmael is living in the wilderness of Paran, and that's an area that's associated with Moab. So the Midrash, first of all, asserts that Ishmael marries a wife from the daughters of Moab. La'achar shalosh shanim, halach Avraham lirot et Yishmael beno. 3 years go by, and Avraham goes to visit his son, right? He misses Yishmael very much. He goes to visit him. V'nishpa l'sarah, shelo yered ma'al ha'gamal, b'makom sh'Yishmael sh'roitman. But when he goes, he has to swear to Sarah that he won't get off his camel when he gets to the place that Ishmael is living. Now, why do you think he has to swear that to Sarah? Why would he have to swear to Sarah that he won't get off his camel? Sounds kind of uncomfortable, right? Yeah, I think so, right? Alana says she's worried that he'll reattach to her. That he'll reattach to him, exactly, right? I think that Sarah knows that Avram really loves Ishmael, right? And she's worried that if he gets off his camel and he stays there for a little while, he might never come home again, right? If he sees Ishmael, right, the bond between them will be so great that he'll just stay there. So in order for Sarah to agree for Avram to go on this trip, he has to swear that he won't get off his camel, because I guess if you won't get off your camel, there's only so long that you can possibly stay there. So Avram sets out to visit Ishmael in Midbar Paran. He gets to where Ishmael lives in the middle of the day. And he finds there this wife of Ishmael, this Moabite woman. So Avram asks the wife, he says, you know, where's Ishmael? She says, oh, he and his mother went off to bring some fruits and dates from the wilderness. You know, they're not home right now. Avram says to her, Tinili ma'at lechem umayim, ki aifa nafshi miderech hamidbar. Avram says to her, well, please give me some bread and some water because I am so tired from my journey. Amra lo, ein lechem, eli lechem velo mayim. She says, well, I don't have any bread. I don't have any water. Can't help you. Sorry. And I would say it's important for the Midrash as it unfolds that the Midrash assumes that this isn't true, right? That it's not that they're really starving and they don't have bread and water. The Midrash is assuming that she just doesn't want to share it with this visitor. So she just says, no, we don't have any. Amarla, so Avram says to her, Kishiyavul Ishmael, hagidi lo et hadvarim ha'ela. When Ishmael comes home, please give him the following message. Tell him the following thing. Please say to him that an old man came from Canaan to visit you. The old man said, change your doorpost because it's not good for you. Now, this is interesting, right? Obviously, the message is in code, right? It's interesting, first of all, that he doesn't ever tell the wife who he is, right? He doesn't say, tell Ishmael that that your father came, right? He just says, tell Ishmael that an old man came from Canaan. And what the old man said to you is that your doorpost is no good. You should change it. Kishabai Ishmael min hamidbar. So when Ishmael comes home from the wilderness at the end of the day, he gide lo et advarim halalu. So the wife passes on the message. Vehivim Ishmael. Ishmael immediately understands the code, right? He understands that the old man from Canaan is in fact his father. He understands that change your doorpost because it's not good for you is code for you change your wife, right? This is, she's not a good wife for you, right? The doorpost, she's kind of the mainstay of your home. She's not good. Ushlacha, and Ishmael obeys his father and divorces his wife, right? He sends her away. Now, I always find this part of the Midrash really to be kind of amazing, right? Because I kind of feel like if I were Ishmael, I might say like, look, you sent me off with nothing but bread and water. I almost died in the desert of thirst. You come to visit me. You don't even wait for me to come home. You just stop by. And the only thing you can tell me is that you don't like my wife, right? If I were Ishmael, I might think like, well, forget it. Like, I don't need to listen to you. But instead, right, in this story, Ishmael immediately kind of understands what his father is saying to him and wants to follow his father's advice, right? He says, if my father thinks my wife is not good for me, I will send her away. And he does. One time I was discussing this Midrash with a person who worked with children who had been abused. And she said that unfortunately, she felt like Ishmael's behavior was actually very aligned with that. That like there's a way in which a child like kind of might continually seek out the approval of their parent, even if they had been mistreated by their parent, which I thought was kind of an especially sad reading of this part of the Midrash. But it could just be also that Ishmael kind of realizes that his father has good advice and, you know, is willing to listen to it. Okay, And the Midrash continues over here in the next paragraph. We're told, "Vishalcha imo v'lakcha lo isha mibeit aviha ufatima shema." So now his mother goes and finds him a new wife, and this wife is from her household, her father's household, right? So she's the new wife is Egyptian, just like Hadar, and the new wife's name is Fatima. And this, I guess, aligns with verse 21 in chapter 21, right? Vatikach lo imo isha me'eretz Mitzrayim, right? His mother found him a wife from Egypt. And here in the Midrash as well, his mother goes and finds him an Egyptian wife. The Midrash adds in a detail, right, that her name is Fatima. We can talk a little bit at the end about why the Midrash might choose to call her Fatima. Three more years go by. Avraham again decides he really wants to see his son. He once again swears to Sarah that he will not get off his camel in the place that Ishmael is found. Anita here said, why would he need Sarah's permission? I think one reason why he would need her permission is that God has specifically told him, do whatever Sarah tells you to, right? So once God says, do whatever Sarah tells you to, then it seems like Abraham kind of wants to obey God, and so therefore is perhaps obeying Sarah as well. And so they strike this deal again where he's able to go as long as he doesn't get off his camel, which again, I would imagine kind of curtails the amount of time he can be there for. He once again arrives in the middle of the day. He again finds Ishmael's wife at home, but now it's not wife number one, who is the Moabite woman. Now it is wife number two, who is the Egyptian woman named Fatima. Amar lahi chanu Ishmael, he asks the wife, where is Ishmael? And she says, he and his mother went off to herd the camels in the wilderness. They are not home right now. So I think at this moment, we should think for one moment about why does Avram keep showing up when Ishmael is not home, right? There's something interesting about that. Now, it could be that, you know, before electricity, like the time to travel was during the day. And if you left, Avram leaves his home in the morning, the time that he's going to get to Ishmael's home just happens to be in the middle of the day, right? That is certainly possible. But it feels a little bit to me like sort of someone who might like call somebody when they know they're not available, right? Like back in the days before cell phones, when people just had phones in their homes, right? It used to be that sometimes if you wanted to call somebody, but you didn't actually want to talk to them, what you could do is call them in the middle of the day when you knew they weren't home. And then you could leave a message. So you'd kind of get like credit for calling them, but you wouldn't actually need to speak with them. And so there's something a little bit interesting about the fact that both times that Avraham shows up, Ishmael isn't there. Right. And again, it could just be that that's the way it works out. Right. He arrives in the middle of the day. It turns out Ishmael is out all day. And so he doesn't see him. But it also feels a little bit like maybe Avraham is going there specifically when he knows Ishmael won't be there because he wants to find out something that he will not be able to know if Ishmael is at home. Seems like what he wants to find out is how will Ishmael's spouse kind of treat a stranger, right? And if Ishmael is home and he, you know, recognizes his father, then Avraham is never going to find out how, you know, what Ishmael's wife will sort of do, you know, if a stranger were to come by, right? Because, you know, he'll only know how she'll treat her father-in-law, which might be very different. So it could be that he comes in the middle of the day specifically because what he wants to do is check out Ishmael's spouse, or it could be that he comes in the middle of the day because that's just when he shows up. At any event, no matter what, he's there the second time. Ishmael is not there. The wife is there. And so Avraham makes the same request of wife number two, of Fatima, that he had made of wife number one. He says to her, give me please some bread and some water because I'm so tired from my travels through the wilderness. So the second wife immediately takes out some bread and some water and gives it to Avraham. Amad Avraham v'hayah mitpalel lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So then Avraham, Amad here is an interesting word. It could either mean that he stands up, right? In which case, maybe that is a violation of his promise not to get off his camel. But Amad could also just mean that he like sort of stays in place, right? He stays in place and he prays before God for his son Ishmael. V'nit malei beito shel Ishmael mikol tuv mimin debrachot. So as he prays for Ishmael, Ishmael's home suddenly becomes filled with all manner of good blessing, right? All this great stuff suddenly appears in their home. Ukishabar Ishmael, higidalo et hadavar. Right. Apparently, then Avram leaves, right, to get home to Sarah. When Ishmael comes home, he suddenly finds that his home is like filled with like all manner of great stuff. And his wife tells him what happened, right? She says, this old man came from Canaan. He asked for some bread and some water. I gave it to him. And suddenly, like, our house was filled with all this great stuff. And Ishmael realizes in that moment that all along his father's mercies are with him, right? That his father has loved him all along. As the verse says, Kirachim aval banim, right? In the way that a father has mercy on his children, the way that a father loves his children. I love this midrash for many reasons. I can talk in a few minutes about why I like this so much. But I think the main point of the midrash, I would say, is this last part, right? Ishmael realizes that Avram has loved him all along, right? The narrator of this midrash wants us to know this, wants us to know that even though it might look like Avram doesn't love Ishmael because he sent him off with only bread and water and Ishmael almost died and we never hear them talking again, we should know, it's important for us to know and for Ishmael to know that actually Avram continues to love Ishmael all along. He's always interested in how he's doing. He always loves him. He always wants what's best for him. And I think what's interesting is that when the Midrash is trying to think of how are we going to know this, right? How is the author of the Midrash going to convey to us that Avram really loves his son Ishmael? I think what the author of this Midrash does is says, well, you know, let's look at how we know that Avram loves Yitzchak, right? There basically are like two main stories with Avram and Yitzchak, right? One is Akedah Yitzchak when Avram tries to kill Yitzchak. And the other main story is in next week's parsha in Chayei Sarah when Avram is very invested in finding a proper spouse for Yitzchak. Those are kind of the two main Avram and Yitzchak stories. And I guess, Ishmael has already had his near-death experience when he almost died of thirst. Maybe I won't. I don't see one nearby. The first, no, I will find one. So Ishmael has already had his near-death experience, but the way for Avram to show us and to show Ishmael that he really cares about him is by showing that it really matters to him who Ishmael is married to, right? And so if we think about it, when Avram was searching for a spouse for Yitzchak, he sends his servant to find a wife for Yitzchak. And the servant realizes that like an important way to know whether the woman will be appropriate for Avram's son Yitzchak is to kind of gauge how hospitable this woman is to strangers, right? So if you remember, the servant says, here's the test when, I'll ask for some water. I'll say, Hagmi'ini nam at mai mikadech, please give me a little bit of water from your pitcher. And the girl who says, yeah, not only can you have some water, but I'll even give your camels water. I'll know that she's the right one because she's so kind to strangers and hospitable. And so that kind of becomes the test there for whether or not the woman is an appropriate spouse for Yitzchak. And the Midrash kind of constructs a similar test over here, right? Avram, when Avram wants to find out, is this woman a proper spouse for Ishmael? What he's looking for is the same thing, right? Is she kind to strangers? Is she hospitable to strangers? The first wife who refuses to give him bread and water seems to not be hospitable. And so Avram advises Ishmael to end that marriage. But the second wife is very hospitable, right? Gives him bread and water immediately. And so at that point, Avraham kind of blesses that marriage by kind of praying and having their home be filled with all manner of good things. So I think on one level, what's going on is that the Midrash wants us to know that Avraham continues to love Ishmael. And the way that the Midrash chooses to show us that Avraham loves Ishmael is by having Avraham take a great and important interest in Ishmael's spouse in the same way that Avraham will take a great and important interest in Yitzchak's spouse. It's actually interesting. When it comes to Yitzchak, Avraham sends the servant to find the right spouse, right? But here, when it comes to Ishmael, he actually goes and checks her out on his own, right? He shows up on his own camel. So it almost feels like in the eyes of the Midrash, Avraham's connection is like slightly more immediate almost because he goes himself to evaluate whether or not the spouse is proper. It's also interesting in the Midrash that the thing that Avram specifically asks for is bread and water, right? Which I think is kind of doubly resonant, right? Both because what Abraham gave Hagar and Ishmael was bread and water when he sent them away. But also, if you'll notice, the first wife is from Moab. And later on in the Torah, Moab and Ammon are the nations that are famously inhospitable, right? If you remember, the people of Israel are told that they are not allowed to ever marry anybody from Ammon and Moab, because the people of Ammon and Moab did not come out and greet them with bread and water as the people of Israel were traveling through the wilderness. And because of the total lack of hospitality of Ammon and Moab, therefore they are not allowed to be a part of the people of Israel. Of course, then there are exceptions, right? The women of Ammon and Moab are allowed to marry Israel, just not the men, right? That's how Ruth the Moabite is able to marry Boaz and so forth. But Moab is kind of famous for being inhospitable, specifically for not sharing bread and water. And so the Moabite wife in the Midrash is also kind of aligned with that, right? She is a Moabite woman. She does not share bread and water. She's not the appropriate spouse. But the second wife does share bread and water. And in fact, in Sefer Dvarim, we're told that we're not supposed to hate the Egyptians, Kiger Hayita Be'artso, because we were strangers in their land. And Rashi there in the Pasuk says, well, when there was a famine, they took us in and gave us food, right? So there's a sense that the Egyptians, they might do all sorts of other bad things, but they do share their food and water with people who are hungry. And sure enough, in this Midrash, the Egyptian wife is kind of seen as sharing bread and water. Yes, it's true, right? When the angels first appear at the beginning of the parsha, the first thing that Avram offers them is, right, yukachnam at ma'im, right? He offers them some bread and some water. And then when they say yes, he then gives them all sorts of other things. So it seems like bread and water is kind of the basic level of hospitality. And that's what Avram is checking. That's what Avram offers in the beginning. And that's what he's kind of checking for over here with Ishmael's wife. Sort of one or two other things that I think are interesting about this Midrash. One is also that the second wife is called Fatima, right? And I think that becomes important for the Midrash, because Fatima is a name that is very important in the Muslim tradition. Fatima is the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. And I think by choosing to call Ishmael's wife Fatima, first of all, it allows scholars, this is one of the reasons why scholars think that the Midrashim of Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer were written in an area under Muslim control, because the name Fatima kind of means something to the author of the Midrash. But I think it's also a way that the author of this Midrash is kind of trying to signal a more contemporary point also. I think the author of this Midrash is basically saying, Avram and Ishmael really love each other all along, right? Whatever kind of falling out that there is really because of Sarah, but Avram on his own loves Ishmael, Ishmael loves Avram, they have a really good relationship. And I think maybe what the author of the Midrash is suggesting is that in the same way that Avram and Ishmael have this good relationship, perhaps, you know, the future descendants of Avraham, you know, of Yitzchak and Ishmael can also perhaps have a good relationship, right? There's a way in which by presenting Avram and Ishmael as having kind of a continued loving relationship, it kind of suggests that there's a possibility of, like, you know, sort of future good feeling between all of Avram's descendants, which it might have been kind of in the author's interest to convey in this Midrash as well. I think mostly what I really like about this story is that it tries to make sense of kind of the emotional valence of chapter 21, right? There's something that just seems very difficult about the fact that Avram is so upset about the thought of sending his son away, but then he could have just sort of sent him away and, like, never heard from him again. There's just something about that seems sort of too hard to believe. And so I think the Midrash kind of steps in and says, yeah, it is too hard to believe. It can't be that that happened. And so the Midrash kind of imagines this scenario where even though the text doesn't tell us about Avraham and Ishmael meeting up, it must be that they did. And that would also, of course, explain why Ishmael comes back to bury his father, because he has this continuing relationship with him. And I think if we think about sort of the parsha overall, kind of starting with last week's parsha with chapter 16, with the birth of Ishmael, and then in this week's parsha in chapter 21, I think there's a sense that in the beginning, Avram doesn't seem particularly invested in this baby that he's going to have with Hagar. Right? It's not his plan at all. It's not his idea. Even once Hagar is pregnant, he says to Sarai, oh, you know, do whatever you want to her, right? He seems like not really concerned at all. But then once Yishmael is born, things seem to totally change for Avram, right? Once Yishmael is born, Avram names him Yishmael. When he's 13 years old, he circumcises him. He's very invested in Yishmael, so much so that when God tells him that he's going to have another child, he's uninterested in having this other child because he has Yishmael already. What more could he want? It's very hard for him to send Yishmael away. And I think there's a sense that Avram has a very strong bond with Yishmael. It's probably specifically because he has a strong bond with Yishmael that Sarah sees Yishmael as kind of a threat to Yitzchak's legacy. And I think that the midrash that we saw in source number 4 is basically a way of trying to kind of both keep the basic storyline of Bereshit, right, with Yitzchak as the covenantal child, but still kind of honor this sort of strong father-son bond that seems to have developed between Avraham and Yishmael. And we can see why Sarai all along, or Sarah at this point, would have been kind of suspicious of Yishmael, right? Her hopes for what was going to happen with the birth of Yishmael really don't pan out at all in chapter 16. And I think the resentment that we start to hear in chapter 16 kind of becomes, you know, really kind of explodes in chapter 21. And because Sarah in chapter 21 now has her own son, she kind of feels like she can call the shots in a different sort of way and demand that that Avraham send Yishmael away. And even so, Avraham might not have listened to her, except God intervenes and specifically, you know, tells Avraham that he should do whatever Sarah said. Okay, it's 9:21. I wanted to leave some time at the end for thoughts and comments. Does anybody want to share anything out loud? If not, I can read through the chat. But if anybody wants to actually say something, I would love to hear you.
I go through the couple questions in the chat, and then hopefully people might
have a comment. Great.
We start from Annie Kowenshin. We wanted to catch a glimpse of his grandchildren, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a great image, right? But maybe he's hoping that by going, he's not just going to see Ishmael, but he's going to see his grandchildren. That would be a great read of it. Francine says, Avram disrespected Sarah by saying she was his sister. I think that's a really great point, Francine, right? The idea somehow that like what Sarai is saying when she says to Avram in chapter 16, Chamasi alecha, my wrong is upon you, right? The Hagar is only kind of daring to disrespect me because she sees that you don't respect me also. I think your suggestion is very much present in the text because we know that Hagar is introduced here as a Shivcha Mitzrit, right, as an Egyptian maidservant. And if you remember, back in last week's parsha, when Avram says to Sarai, Imrina Achotiat, please say that you're my sister so that things will be good for me, then Paro takes Sarai and in exchange gives Avraham all of these servants, right? All of these slaves. And so it seems like it's quite likely, right? Even apart from the Midrash that Hagar is really Paro's daughter and so forth, right? Even just kind of in the plain meaning of it, it seems likely that Hagar joined their household because of Sarai being taken into Paro's home, which would mean that Hagar knows all along that the relationship that Avraham and Sarai have is one in which he's willing to sort of sacrifice Sarai for his own benefit or his own safety. So I think that's a great point there, right? The disrespect, you know, kind of probably dates back to that point in Egypt, and Hagar would be well aware of it if that's the point that she joined the household. Was Avram hoping that Hagar let me just find that. I like that suggestion a lot. This was the suggestion of Cohen. I don't know what Cohen's first name is, but Cohen says, was Avram hoping Hagar and her son could return soon? That's a really great suggestion also. I wonder about that, right? Maybe the reason why he doesn't give them so much stuff is that he's hoping that when they run out of stuff, they'll turn around and come back. I remember when I was young, I read a book. I don't know if anybody here ever read the Ramona stories, but Ramona was this little girl. And at one point she decides that she's going to run away from home because she thinks her family doesn't love her. And so her mom says, okay, well, I'll help you pack, Ramona. Ramona's like horrified. It's one thing, you know, for her family not to stop her, but for her mom to actually help her pack to run away is terrible. And her mom, of course, like tells her to take all of her heaviest things, her roller skates, everything that's really heavy. And then once the suitcase is really full, Ramona can't even lift it. And then she realizes that her mom, of course, doesn't want her to run away, so, you know, making her suitcase on purpose too heavy. And so I often think about whether Avram is doing something similar, right? Not making the suitcase too heavy, but basically not giving them enough supplies to really be able to make it, in the hopes that he could then kind of like check the box of listening to Sarah. Sarah said, cast her out. So he does. But if she comes back a few hours later, because she's running out of bread and water, like, well, now she's back again. So I wonder about that, you know, and in that case, what the narrative would be is that, she got lost, right? That was the problem. Like, Avram's plan would have worked out well. She would have, you know, gone a few hours, run out of food, come home again, except once she gets lost in the wilderness, she can't come home again. And that might be how the story proceeds. But I think that's a great suggestion. Ishmael was not a young child, so how could Hagar have carried him on her shoulder? That's a great question also from Amalia. There's something very strange about it, right? When you read through the story in chapter 21, Ishmael sounds very little, right? It sounds like, I mean, it's not actually totally clear in the verse whether the boy is on her shoulder or whether the bread and water are on her shoulder. Oh, sorry. But afterwards, it's not super clear. It might be that the bread and the water are on her shoulder, but I definitely agree with you that Ishmael is described as like a yeled. He sounds younger than you would imagine. And I don't know if that's maybe because that's the way his parents thought of him, right? Sometimes you can have kids who are 16 or 17, but their parents kind of think of them as being very young. I have one cousin in my family who's like the youngest of all the cousins. And even though he's 30, like if you asked any of us, we'd probably think he's 5, right? So it could just be that, you know, that in Hagar's mind, he's very young and vulnerable. And that's why the text describes him that way. I recently saw a very disturbing suggestion in Ramban. Ramban says that maybe Ishmael was sick on the day that Abraham threw them out, and that's why Hagar had to carry him. And that seems especially sad, right? To like sort of throw them out of the house with Ishmael being too sick to walk. Like, that almost seems too painful to even say. But Ramban suggests it, I think, probably because of that question, right? Why is Hagar kind of carrying him? Okay, and then Anita said, why would he need her permission? So I think that is probably, again, I would say because God has specifically said, you know, whatever Sarah tells you to do, you should do. So my guess is that would kind of extend to like anything having to do with Ishmael afterwards. Alana says, it doesn't sound like he did as he promised. Oh, in terms of not getting off his camel, I guess maybe he could eat the bread and water while he's on the camel. It's a good question. Or maybe as long as Ishmael isn't there, it doesn't count as the place that Ishmael is. So then he could get off his camel. Okay. Esther says, Fatima was the name of Muhammad's daughter. If this midrash originated in 9th century Muslim lands. Yeah, I think one of the reasons why scholars think that this midrash originated in Muslim lands is specifically because of things like this, of like these little clues, like the name Fatima that is mentioned over here. Even though Avram only visits Ishmael every 3 years, Avram only checks out Ishmael's spouse post factum. Hagar found the second wife. So that's a great point, Ellen. The very next passage in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer describes how after, maybe not the very next one, but soon afterwards, there's a description of how after Sarah dies, Avraham goes and marries Hagar. And so I think the Midrash is, you know, remarries Hagar. In the text, if you remember, Avraham marries a woman named Keturah, but the Midrash in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer asserts entirely positively that Keturah is really Hagar. And I think one of the ways that the Midrash kind of asserts that Hagar is a good second spouse for Avram is that she's able to find the right wife for Ishmael, right? Left to his own devices, he finds this woman from Moab who isn't so great, but his mother kind of, you know, has the right set of values. She finds the proper spouse for him in Egypt. And I think it's a way of kind of bolstering Hagar's image as well. Okay, great. Any other thoughts or comments?
If I may, if you want to comment on the fact that Avraham kind of discusses or gets permission from Sarah how he'll act with Ishmael. But when we go to the Akedah, Sarah's like totally left out of the picture. Like he takes Yitzchak to the Akedah without telling. I mean, I understand why, but it just kind of, the parallel is interesting that according to the Medrash, you know, he'll ask Sarah for permission by Ishmael, but not for Yitzchak, which is her.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that he knows that if he promises, right, he can have a negotiation with Sarah where in the end, if he makes the right promise about not getting off his camel, she'll say it's okay for him to see Ishmael. But he probably knows that under no circumstances is she going to agree to have him sacrifice Yitzchak. So that might be why.
Sure. I mean, I'm just saying, just the parallel is interesting. Okay, yeah. Any comments, questions? Otherwise, thank you very much for that.
I had a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so two comments. One, when Sarai gets angry with Avraham, I was thinking that maybe she's also angry with herself because it was her idea. And sometimes if you're angry with yourself, you might cast the blame on somebody else.
So Annie, I think that's a really great insight, right? Because she like lashes out at Avram, but you kind of, yeah, it makes sense. Maybe she's saying to herself, like, what was I thinking? Like, how could I possibly have thought that this would be a good plan? Now, one thing that we could say about that is that, you know, I would say, you know, reading the story with modern eyes, right? We would say like, come on, Sarai, what were you thinking? How could you possibly think this was a good plan to like bring this other woman into your marriage? Except if we think about the stories later on in Bereshit, right, when Leah and Rachel give their maids as concubines to Yaakov to try to, you know, use them as surrogates to have children, there it kind of seems to happen kind of without issue, right? I mean, we don't know what Bilhah and Zilpah thought about it, but certainly from the perspective of Rachel and Leah, there's like no great drama about it. So it seems as if maybe in other circumstances, it kind of worked out without too much of a problem, but here it really doesn't. And I agree with you that maybe Sarai is kind of mad at herself for even suggesting it and, you know, kind of bringing about the situation.
The other one was that when you said about her carrying him on his shoulder, him on her shoulder,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's a metaphor. The child must be very sad and very, you know, sad that his father is casting him out. So if she's carrying him on her shoulder, it means she at that point she's comforting him or she's giving him emotional support as they leave. Things will be okay, etc., etc. I mean, later on, she doesn't give him the support when he's dying, but at least when they left, she was supporting him in leaving.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely reading of it. And it's so sad, right? It's sad that like, that Sarah tells Avram that he has to be the one to cast them out, right? All of it just seems very painful. It's probably why I like this image of, you know, Avram continuing to visit him afterwards. It's like kind of paying a nice coda to it. Okay, guys, it was so great to learn with you. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to get to discuss Parshat Vayera together. Thanks.
Wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Sunday morning, Menachem Leiptag, 11 a.m., continuing our shiur from Cyrus to Lord Balfour on the Beit Sheni period in Tanakh, followed right afterwards, coming to break, Rav Rimon, the second part of Ishir on technology, Bivrit, Ashir Shania Bivrit, as you all know, were there last week on technology and Shabbat artificial intelligence, and then all our regular Shirim during the week. And as I mentioned this morning, I'll send out an email Wednesday, 2:15 p.m., 9:15 in Israel. Lori Novak is starting a series on issues and sort of women and halakha. From the textual basis on tzitzit, tefillin, kriyas haTorah, all the heavy issues that I'm sure Wendy is well aware of.
Lori was my chavruta in Drisha. She's amazing.
I'll tell her. Okay, I didn't tell her. You know, I'm in con. I'll have to tell her you spoke tonight.
Yeah, totally.
And then Ilana Sober is going to give a couple of classes for those who are in Toronto. Know Ilana when she spent a number of years here. So, but Lori's going to be doing most of the classes, but Ilana will do a couple. So, right. So she's going to start, I think, Shema, Tzitzis, Tfilin, Zimun, Kriyas HaTorah. I don't know if I have the exact order, but anyways, that's going to be about, I don't know, a 12-part series. So that's going to start this Wednesday, 2:15. We'll send out the registration link a little bit later. So that's our new shiur for this upcoming week. So we got lots going on the Torah Motion Zoom channel, you know, every day to learn Torah. So Bakasha, we look forward to learning with you. And Wendy, thank you again. And it's very thank nice. You. Also, you and Lori were chavrusas and Trisha.
Yeah, wow. Totally.
It really is a small world. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. Shabbat Shalom.
Okay. Be well. Shabbat Shalom, everybody.